Welcome to Food and Life Freedom, the podcast that helps you heal your relationship with food and body. Today, I am joined by Nikki Hesthaus, a registered dietitian and yoga teacher, and we're exploring stress, the nervous system, and gut health. We generally associate gut discomfort directly with food, but as we will explore, our gut symptoms are influenced by many processes in our body. And often food is not the first place we should be looking to make changes. This conversation is so interesting, and I'm sure you will learn a lot. If you relate to having IBS or gut discomfort, you may find some new ideas for how to find relief. There's also some bird sounds in the background on my end, so if you like birds, maybe this is for you as well. I'm Emma Townsend, a UK registered dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor. I support clients to stop stressing over food rolls and to naturally eat in a way that supports their body and mind. This episode is brought to you by Reclaiming Your Food Freedom, an online course that brings you all the tools and support you need for a healthy relationship with food and body. To learn more about how you can reclaim your food freedom, head to foodlifefreedom.com. And of course, because we are all unique, this episode cannot offer personalized advice. So please use this as an opportunity to learn and explore. But if something does not feel right for you, then it's not meant for your unique self. And if you have any health concerns, please seek personalized support from a registered healthcare provider. So let's dive straight into this episode on stress, the nervous system, and gut health. So today, I'm really happy to introduce our guest today. This is Nikki Hesthaus. She's a registered dietitian in Australia and New Zealand, and she's also a yoga teacher. And we're going to be talking about stress, the nervous system, and the gut health with Nikki today. So Nikki, how did you get involved in, or how did you start specializing in stress, the nervous system, and gut health?
Oh, well, first, hi, Em, and thanks for having me on your podcast. I guess it's quite a long-winded story. Working as a dietitian for, 10 years or so now, and I also then trained as a yoga teacher when I was living in London. And when I returned to New Zealand, kind of pre-COVID years, I started working in the gut health space. Most of the time, I was working with women with IBS, and the more I worked with these women, the more I could see that stress was such a big trigger for their symptoms. Yet every other health professional they'd seen, whether that be their doctor or a nutritionist or naturopath or whoever they had seen, they were just told, oh, you just need to manage your stress better. But they just, if they knew how to do that, then they would have been off doing that on their own. We just don't really, as a society, understand what stress actually is and what happens in our body when we are stressed. So we don't really understand how we need to manage it. And then also how it all connects with the gut and our symptoms and just how we manage that whole big cycle.
Yeah, definitely. And we know that the gut plays such a huge role in stress and our emotions and so many other aspects besides just digesting our food as well. We're learning so much more recently about that. When we think of stress as well, I think we all think like get told by the doctor that we need to just reduce our stress. But if stress wasn't important for us, it wouldn't be a response that we get, or we wouldn't feel stress. So what role does stress actually play? Is there a way that it's maybe beneficial or important for us as well?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because stress does get quite a bad rap. Like, we always talk about it really negatively. And I guess just to kind of take a step back, when we're talking about stress, we're talking about the body's physiological response or reaction to something that could be physical, whether it's like an internal or external situation, or it could be psychological, or it could be a social stress. And so I guess when we are in a stress state, our nervous system's activating, And that can actually be really helpful because it speeds up how our body functions. It could increase our heart rate, increases our breathing rate. It decreases something called heart rate variability, which is super important to understand. And it moves the body into that fight or flight state. And that's when the sympathetic nervous system's dominant. And it's so important for us to understand that that's actually a good thing, because if you're in danger, you want to be able to respond quickly and you want sharp reflexes for things like you're about to drop your cup of tea on the floor, or you want to catch your child if they're going to fall down the stairs. Like, you need your body to be able to respond quickly and to be activated in that sympathetic nervous system state. But there's also some other things, I guess, that cause a stress response in the same way that we often think is kind of quote unquote positive. So like when we're excited, our body responds the exact same way. And we're pregnant, when we're doing heavy exercise, and also when we're in high heat, so like going into a sauna. So those sort of things, you know, we might talk about them as positive things in society, but your body is actually responding in the exact same way to that stress. In the same way as we would talk about, I guess, the more negative things like being overloaded or being in pain or being fatigued from lack of sleep or jet lag, I guess, or more like psychological stresses like fear or an anxiety, which all cause the body to activate in that same way.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And when we look at things, there's never really a good or bad. Our body has these responses for a reason. And if a response is designed as something that is, say, fairly short term to help us through a situation or to prepare us for a situation, it's going to have these positive benefits in that situation. But if we put it into maybe what we experience nowadays with more chronic stress or this like work-related stress, or maybe stress of things like dieting, these longer term stresses, we're putting our body in a short term state for a lot longer. And that's when it can become harmful for us.
Yeah. And also that it's not actually the stress that's the problem. And I think that's when people get told they need to manage their stress or they need to get rid of stress in their life. Like, stress is inevitable. We're going to have it at different periods of time. It's going to be in higher, we're going to have higher stress at different times depending what's going on. But I guess the main problem, or I guess situation we want to overcome, is the balance between stress and recovery. So is stress so much that you're becoming overloaded because there's not enough recovery to help you switch off? So like when we talk about recovery, that's when we're able to regulate the nervous system to move us into that sort of rest and digest state where the parasympathetic nervous system is dominant and our body can calm down and our heart rate can decrease and we can slow our breathing down and relax easier. And, you know, that is more what we want to focus on. One, because it's something we can have more control over, which can help us feel more positive about the situation. But also it's balancing that so that the amount of stress you have in your life is actually manageable. And so you might be really high performing and you might have a lot of demands on you, but if you've got enough recovery and you're actually able to rest and recover, you can then kind of recharge your, I could say, like body battery. You can like bring your body resources back up so that when you come into a new day, you've got the resources there to be able to get through what you need to get through.
Yeah, that's such a good point. The focus is usually on the stress and we need to stop this stress, but stress is, as you said, inevitable. We're all going to experience stress to different levels, but it's always going to be there. And there might be some stresses that we can maybe reduce. There's a lot of stresses, as you said, that we can't reduce. So that's really interesting to shift that focus to the recovery between stresses so that, yeah, we have the resources to cope with this inevitable stress that we're going to experience. So when we look at, say, gut health and a lot of the gut symptoms people experience, maybe things like bloating, IBS symptoms, there's a lot of focus perhaps on the food with that as well. We think of the gut as just digesting food, so the focus can often be on things like food and restricting food. But we know that the gut actually plays a really important role in our stress response and other emotions as well. How does the gut impact our stress, or how does stress impact the gut? I think it can maybe go both ways as well.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely goes both ways because of the gut-brain connection and how the gut and the brain are constantly communicating with each other. And yes, it could be physical stress or it could be psychological stress, but the way the nervous system is being activated will then affect the way the gut functions. So say we're in a stressed state and that sympathetic nervous system is dominant, it starts, I guess, from the mouth, and like the reaction to that is that you have less saliva being produced, and saliva is a big part of the first stage of digesting our food. Like when we chew it and the saliva, it helps break it down. So that's just a real basic first step of how that can kind of slow down digestion. But it can also disrupt further down how the gut's functioning. So when we are in that fight or flight state and the body decreases the amount of blood flow going to the digestive system, so it's going, what's going to the gut, so that's then going to slow down the gut and how it's digesting your food. And then you can start to feel maybe some bloating, or maybe it can cause constipation for you if that can be a problem. And it then can also increase, well, tension in the body. Full stop. Often people feel that, like in their jaw when they're stressed. That could be a first state. But that's the same thing, I guess, in the muscles around the digestive system as well. So that could cause cramping or pain. And in general, when the body is in that stress state, it increases our sensitivity to pain. And then when the gut is in that, when the body's in that state, the gut is then can send receptors to the brain, and it then increases your perception of pain. So you could get that abdominal pain with bloating or constipation, and that all just kind of makes any gut symptoms you've got, it can just make them a lot worse, and it can sort of be the main underlying trigger. And what you said earlier about what we're sort of dealing with more often now being chronic stress, that's something where more chronic stress can affect the bacteria in our gut, mainly because of the fact that the body's producing more cortisol, and that can affect that the sort of makeup and the composition of the types of bugs and the gut microbiome. And we can often see less of our kind of beneficial gut bugs and more of those that aren't going to produce products that are good necessarily for some of our internal health. So in the long run, it can really affect the actual way the gut functions and the health of the gut as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think some of the things that really stand out is the sensitivity maybe of the signals between the gut and the brain. So we might be experiencing the same physical level of something like bloating, but the gut will be more sensitive in communicating that to the brain, or maybe the brain is more sensitive as well in picking that up as a pain signal. So we're then going to experience that as something that's painful, rather than it maybe passing us by or just being this bloating sensation that comes in and passes without causing that pain as well. So Nikki, you were just touching on things as well, like bloating and constipation, and how that can be impacted by stress as well. How often do you see maybe IBS symptoms that are triggered maybe more so by stress rather than needing to make those food modifications?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, well, I'd like to say majority of the time, because it's not the first thing that people think of. I mean, you know, if someone gets diagnosed with IBS or they maybe self-diagnose themselves, or they are just feeling a bit bloated, that always the first thought for the majority of people is it has to be something I ate. And then the next thought is, okay, so I should cut something out. And the two biggest things that people always start with is dairy or gluten or both. But they might cut these things out for a few days or a week or something, and then they'll sort of be like, oh yeah, there were some days that were good and then my symptoms came back. So then they'll try cut something else out, and then they'll cut something else out, and it's just this sort of big web of restriction that gets, I guess, more and more severe because they're doing it on their own and they are not replacing these foods with anything, you know, from a nutritional perspective, but also just that they're more afraid that to bring those things back in if they've already cut them out but they're still getting symptoms, so they just leave them out and they just go to the next thing and cut more out. But more often than not, like, yeah, they've made all these they've restricted all these things, and then you start to talk to them about what's actually gone on, like, why have your symptoms got worse in the last 2 years? The number of people whose symptoms got exponentially worse during the height of the pandemic is just, it's just unbelievable to see. And so much of it has been stress, the change in their lifestyle from working remotely, like university students who just cannot work remotely and were forced to for such a long period of time. And then all of a sudden, as soon as they went back to classes in term and had this regular social contact and they had this kind of support network and safety net for them, all of a sudden their symptoms were just gone. And some people cannot even fathom that it could be something other than food, but so often it is one of the biggest drivers. And it doesn't necessarily mean that food is not potentially a trigger as well, but you can't decipher which foods are actually the triggers if you've still got high levels of stress and your nervous system being activated far too often and not enough rest and recovery, because the gut just doesn't even get a chance to function at its best if we're always in that activated sort of fight or flight state. And yeah, I think the biggest thing is that even though people come to me to talk about food straight away and they want to know exactly what it is that's causing their symptoms, always it's taking a step back to look at, well, how are we actually going and living day to day? Are you actually sleeping? You're not going to bed before 2 a.m. How is your gut going to have any time to recover before you give it more food the next day? So there's so many small things that we just do every day without thinking that would actually play a much bigger role than potentially, you know, cutting out foods in the first instance.
Yeah, definitely. And I love when you say that we can't even know the impact that food itself is having or particular foods are having until we step back and have a look at all of the other underlying triggers. And as you mentioned, your clients may be doing it on their own before they reach out to you, or just having these symptoms and trying to cut out food based on information they see online as well. We could be cutting out foods that on their own have no symptoms to us, that if we're eating them when we just, I guess, dive into these underlying triggers first, they're fine, they're foods we enjoy, they're foods that fit in with our life really well. But when we cut them out, we've still got all these underlying triggers, we're not actually addressing the stress on the gut and what's going on to cause the symptoms.
And in addition to the stress and particular types of food, I guess the other thing is how we eat. So whether or not even just basic things too. Are we having regular meals? Are we trying to get our entire day's fiber intake in one meal and it's dinner because it's the only meal you've eaten all day? Or are we just living off coffee from when we get up in the morning to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon? So your gut is stimulated and caffeine causes a stress response in the body too. But then also we haven't actually nourished ourselves with anything that's going to then help the digestive system work properly. And then we go have a big meal for dinner and then we get all these symptoms afterwards, which doesn't necessarily mean there's actually anything going on or wrong with the gut itself. It's more the patterns of eating and even just something as regular meal times and regular food intake just helps the gut function a lot more efficiently.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the high fiber intake with one meal as well, that's something I see really, really often because our culture tends to put things like fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables, up on this top hierarchy of food and make those foods feel more important for us, or they're the foods we should be trying to eat the most of. But really they're just one of the balance of foods that our body needs. They're not more important than anything else. And what I see is people trying to cram so many vegetables, especially when it's things like salad vegetables, like raw vegetables, into a meal to try to maybe either it's helping the gut symptoms or it's just trying to be healthier in that sense. But that amount of fiber in one go is often too much for the gut. A lot of low energy foods as well. The gut's not getting the energy. The body's not getting the energy it needs. But it's got a whole heap of work to do with all that fiber that's going in.
Yeah, and I think we talk about fiber a lot with the gut, and that's really because it's the main food source for the bugs that live in our gut, and they love it, and it keeps our gut healthy. But fiber is, it's a delicate balance with fiber. As soon as you have slightly more than what your gut's used to, you will likely feel a little bit bloated, or you might get a little bit constipated because you need more water and you need to move your body to be able to get the full benefits of it. And so if all of a sudden people decide, oh, I need to change what I'm eating because I want to be healthier, or I need my gut to be healthier, or I need to, you know, get rid of these symptoms, all of a sudden they go from having like one, you know, coffee all day till 3 o'clock and then dinner to a high fiber breakfast, a high fiber lunch, a high fiber dinner, and then they're going to be, you know, they might then be bloated and constipated for the next 3 days and just think, well, this has just made everything worse.
Yeah.
But it is that delicate balance of just having to gradually find what feels the best for your gut. But there's also other great foods that actually we need, like what you said, for balance. It's like your gut needs, you know, all of the good like fats. We need protein. We need, it's like fiber's not the be all and end all when it comes to making up what makes a good meal for your gut. We just need to find, I guess, the balance of keeping the gut healthy so it can keep us functioning at our best, but at the same time not overloading it because we think the more is better, because not necessarily, it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, definitely that can apply to a lot of things in life as well. I'm curious as well, often people might be having these kind of generalized, maybe IBS symptoms, things like bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and they can't really pin it down to a particular food. But they'll also say, oh, but I don't really feel stressed, or, you know, it's not coming up at times that I particularly like feel that I am stressed. So maybe it's, you know, studying for something. It's kind of more random than that. Can we feel the stress maybe the same way that our gut feels, or is it generally a direct connection between our perceived level of stress and maybe the stress the gut's experiencing?
Yeah, it's really interesting because sometimes we need to look at what's happening inside and what's happening with our nervous system, because we can't necessarily feel. I guess we could liken it to when we maybe, like if we've kind of lost that perception of hunger and fullness, we have to kind of reconnect with that and relearn what does that feel like for me. And the same goes with stress, because like what you said, the chronic stress that a lot of people experience, but it can be in the form of stress. It could be anxiety, it could be depression, it could be trauma, it could be some form of chronic stress, but that's just the way that person has functioned for a very long period of time. So they don't necessarily know what it feels like to switch off properly. Well, they might think they're switching off. Maybe they sit down and read a book, or maybe they go for a walk, or maybe they watch a movie, but their body is not actually relaxing. Like, it's not actually moving into that rest and digest state. So it sounds quite technical, but what I use with my clients is it's a research grade wearable which tracks heart rate variability. And so the essence of heart rate variability is that, as I said before, with when our nervous system goes into that fight or flight state, our heart rate increases. But the heart rate variability, which is, I guess, the measurement between beats, that will decrease when we're stressed, and it will increase when we're in recovery. So when we're able to measure that for a period of time, whether that be a day, 3 days, 5 days, we start to see patterns. So we get to see, what does it take to move you from being in a stress state to be in a recovery state? And so, is that 20 minutes of reading a book? Is it 10 minutes of meditation before bed to help you get into to quickly get into restorative sleep? So what is it? And often people need to see it, and they need to see the data to be able to actually identify, oh, well, maybe I was feeling a little bit stressed then still, or that phone call I had made me feel very on edge afterwards, and then they didn't do anything else to wind down before sleep, so then it affected their sleep and they were waking with these stress periods throughout the night. And when you get all of that information, that's where it can really pinpoint the parts of the day that either continually cause them high levels of stress, or where they can start to bring in, I guess, little things during the day to help them get little pockets of recovery during the day, and particularly to help them have a nice restorative sleep at night, which ultimately is then going to help them recharge to then deal with the next day. So even when people talk about, you know, their lifestyle and their symptoms, often it's diving into actually what's happening inside, what's happening with your heart rate, what's happening with the nervous system. And that's what it actually takes to be able to understand that and see that, and how that then could be affecting their symptoms and the energy level and pretty much just how they're functioning day to day.
Yeah, that's so fascinating that we might be so used to this stress state that we don't feel it as the stress state. So whatever kind of stress that is that we've maybe had for a long time, we don't know what it's like to be completely without that. And then if we add to that as well, we start getting stressed about the symptoms we're experiencing. So we're getting these really uncomfortable symptoms that are maybe affecting us being able to actually live our life or concentrate, go out with friends. That becomes stressful, that adds to the cycle. And what I also see as well is that we might try to bring in food changes, so blaming the food, bringing in those food changes, and then that can be really stressful trying to follow, say, a particular way of eating. There's a really fascinating study as well looking at dieting, so low-calorie dieting and our stress response, and it found in those who were following the low-calorie diet, their cortisol levels were actually raised compared to those who weren't following a low-calorie diet. So we do know that food restriction itself, or restricting our body from the energy that it needs, does have that trigger that stress response as well, because that is stressful for the body when it's not getting the energy that it needs.
And that goes back to the what I said earlier with that chronic stress and that increase in cortisol and how it changes the balance of the gut microbiota. And
yeah,
I would have to say that I have actually seen that quite often with clients, that their symptoms have got worse once after they've lost weight. And
yep.
Usually it's from either a low carb diet, so that they're, I guess, not been having any high fiber or limiting their high fiber food. So their gut hasn't been able to, the gut bugs haven't been able to feed off the fiber. But also just the calorie restriction, full stop.
And when we think about food, and especially the energy, so the calories, which is the unit of energy, that is the most basic part of food that our body needs. Our body needs that energy for all of the different processes. So if that's restricted, or if our body just fears that's restricted because it's really irregular, it's natural that's going to raise the stress response in our body. Because we're cutting out a basic need for our body, and it needs to be alert to be able to find food. It needs to be alert to be able to seek food when it's available.
Yeah.
So we know that we really need to dive into the underlying triggers. So what's actually going on besides food first? Are there any times that maybe for someone their symptoms are more related to food? Perhaps it's after we've already looked at the stress response as well, or perhaps they are getting symptoms that are maybe they could put it down to a certain food, or maybe it's not so random like we might see with a stress response. Is there any maybe particular kind of foods that you do see showing up quite a lot, or any way that we can know is it worth trying food first, or is it worth maybe looking into other things?
Yeah, I mean, it would depend who you talk to as to whether they would say a food first, because I guess mainstream medicine, once someone's been diagnosed with IBS, they'll usually get an A4 piece of paper about the low FODMAP diet and then told to go low FODMAP. They may or may not get referred to a dietitian to help them with that. But ultimately, it's someone who has, they've had debilitating symptoms. They've symptoms that have obviously got to the point that affect their life so much they can't keep going with the way their symptoms are. And then they maybe have some investigations. They get told that there's nothing actually wrong with their gut, which doesn't make sense because it doesn't align with how they're feeling. And I guess from a medical perspective, it's the gut is still healthy. There's not anything sinister going on there. But from a functional perspective, it's not functioning the way it like would ultimately like it to function, so it wouldn't cause all these symptoms. So I guess we're then telling these people who are already in this state of being so stressed out by their symptoms, because they cause either them to affect, it affects their life in so many ways. I guess they might miss out on social events. They might not be able to enjoy food in a social situation because they're too scared of what to eat. It might mean that they can't exercise or do things that they enjoy, which then it's quite a cycle, because exercise is such a good thing to help keep our gut symptoms under control, but also to keep our gut healthy. So then handing them this sort of A4 sheet of paper about what you need to then cut out just adds an extra layer of stress on top of that. And then like what we talked about with the food restriction and that cycle, it then leads to a whole nother avenue that we don't really want people to go down. I guess the first step would ideally be like, don't tell them to do the low FODMAP diet. Just let them understand more about the gut-brain connection and the dysregulation that happens in IBS. And that is ultimately the ideal first step, because then the first piece of information they get after being told they have IBS is that it is to do with your entire body. It is your brain and your gut and how it communicates with each other. And yes, it's going to be affected by how you live your life and the food you eat and what you drink. But it's all of that. It's not just cut out some foods and go on a low FODMAP diet. And that's where you have to take that. It's like they're a whole person. They have to be treated like a whole person. And IBS is a functional condition, so therefore, it's making sure that they understand it's affected by everything in their life. The main, I guess, when you ask about whether there's someone that should start with a food first approach, it would really it depends on what they've tried already, because a lot of these people might have tried doing some things like bringing in meditation to help manage their stress, or they might have just started to try and include some more exercise if they feel, you know, that helps their bloating or constipation. And you know, they might have made steps to increase the way they manage their stress or to improve their sleep. You know, they might have made some of those changes already, and that's great. So they might have seen some improvements, but if there's still, I guess, lingering symptoms that potentially could be influenced by what they eat. But it also goes back to how they're eating. So are they having regular meal patterns? Okay, let's just even begin there. Let's start at the beginning. And there's a lot of considerations that would need to be taken into account before you even start talking about whether someone needs to cut out foods. And so it's like, what type of food do they already eat? So what have they tried cutting out already? How long did they do it for? How do their symptoms change throughout the year? Because seasonally we eat different foods at different times of year because different produce is in season, you know, fruit and veg wise. And you know, but how much autonomy do they have to even make changes? So do they shop for their own food? Like, do they cook their food? Are they going to be asking someone else in their household to cook them a low FODMAP meal or force their whole family to change what they're eating? You know, do they have particular cultural dishes that they include, and are those things that they want to modify to even see if there are, you know, particular things that are triggers there? Do they even have the cooking skills to be able to change what they're eating, or do they actually buy their food for all their meals? So trying to find meals that maybe are lower in FODMAPs outside of home is really difficult, but maybe it's also a part of their life. Like maybe their eating out is a huge part of their social life, or maybe it's part of work. Like they want to take clients out and wine and dine clients, so they're going to be having lots of different cuisines and different meals. And you know, there's so many different factors. And like what you said, I guess the sort of stress and anxiety about the symptoms, and then potentially the idea of taking foods out or bringing foods in can cause more stress or anxiety. And not until all of that is really well understood would you even start to talk about what food modifications would actually be appropriate to start with. And there definitely could be some that might have a beneficial effect, but I think the biggest misconception, particularly when people talk about the low FODMAP diet, because that's probably the most common, I guess, way of eating with IBS, is that it's a low FODMAP diet. It's not no FODMAPs. There's no food that you ever have to cut out completely to manage gut symptoms. And I think that's what causes more stress than anything, is that someone might love pasta and then they're told you need to cut out wheat, but actually maybe you just need to reduce it and we can't have it 2 days in a row because that's going to cause your symptoms to flare up. But if you had it, you know, with at least 2 or 3 days in between, you know, having a pasta dish, then maybe your symptoms are a lot more settled if you did that. So that's where when people are trying to do it on their own, I can totally see how it gets so overwhelming and it can get so stressful and it can make everything seem too hard and make their symptoms worse. but that's where methodically working through some of those things is just so important to help them understand how to approach it and where to even start.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think something you really got into there that's so important is we don't eat in isolation from the rest of our life. Food isn't just this fuel for our body that we don't experience as part of our social life, as part of our connection, as something that gives us pleasure and joy in life as well. So if we are focusing on restricting food, it's not just, oh, don't eat these particular foods and, you know, have something else instead. It's actually like, are you cutting out pleasure and joy that you have from these particular foods that you really enjoy eating or that provide comfort to you? Are we restricting your ability to maybe socialize? And you mentioned even like work can be affected for some people if eating out is a big part of the workplace. Is our culture then being affected as well? We can't fully engage in these cultural experiences that we have because we're having to cut out those foods that are a big part of our culture. And as you mentioned, we can go into a doctor's office and we just get a sheet of paper as if that's what we're meant to do, but that's not considering the whole person and what food means to them as well. Mm. And another thing that you mentioned that really stuck out is that sometimes looking at what they're eating, sometimes it's that they don't have this regular food intake going into the gut. We often think of IBS as, oh, we need to maybe restrict certain foods. But actually, for a lot of people, their food is already restricted, as you mentioned, or their eating is quite irregular. Maybe they're following some kind of diet, like a low-calorie diet, and actually it's bringing back that regular eating for the gut, which is where it's going to function best, and making sure the gut and our body has enough, making sure it's got that regular intake. That can often be the first thing to look at for some people, or the first food change that we make.
Absolutely. And even that can be quite a huge step for someone when they're being so anxious about what causes their symptoms.
Yeah.
You then tell them that they have to, when you tell them that they could try eat more regularly, or we could talk about foods that they could actually introduce. So we try and focus on like what they can have rather than what they think they can't have for their symptoms.
Yeah.
That could still be quite a huge adjustment for people.
So Nikki, how do you work with people to manage their stress and gut health?
Yeah, so I mostly work one-on-one with women, and I don't take on a huge number of clients because the way I work with these women is quite intensive over a period of 6 months to make sure that they get my undivided attention and focus. So the program has 4 pillars, and they don't we don't work through them in any particular order. We start with looking at where someone is at and I guess what their main sort of area of focus is of where they want to begin. So I mean, some people may be really needing to focus on stress to start with, or they might need to learn how to tune back into their body and what it's telling them, or they might need to slowly increase just their general knowledge about foods and nutrition and what their gut needs just to function at a basic level. So I guess most women can come at a different stage. I would say the majority have some stress, and they'd sort of be juggling that personal life, work life, probably also kids involved there, and there's sort of this hamster on a wheel situation where that stress is like what we've said, it's the chronic stress. It's where they've got to the point where that's like, oh, that's just how they function every day. But if we actually get them to move into this sort of rest and recovery state, they then realize how exhausted they are because they've been in this stress state for so long. And so I get over the program, we do a baseline measurement using the First Beat Life, which is the research grade wearable, which will look at stress, recovery, exercise, and then that just gives us a bit of an insight into like where's the body functioning right now. The great thing with that is we can also kind of map where the main symptoms are coming in if they have some very prevalent gut symptoms that are not necessarily related to food. They could eat whatever and they still get symptoms. So you map all of that out alongside that, and that gives us a really good baseline to see, well, what's actually going on? Where do we need to bring in some pockets of recovery during the day? What small changes can we make? And then over that 6 months, just with regular coaching, and we do regular measurements as well with the device to see how the nervous system is changing and responding to these changes. And then with regards to their gut symptoms, like that's always going to be part of it, and their gut health is always going to be part of it. But that might be the reason they come in, but it's often not the main area of focus throughout the whole journey, yet it's still just as important as everything else. But it's about kind of getting the foundation and laying the foundation for their physical and mental functioning to then look at, well, actually, where are the gut symptoms now? What else do we need to change? Or is it more just now about eating for pleasure and joy, feeling confident that you know what to cook for you and your family, finding foods that you actually enjoy eating, and then bringing all of that in as kind of an added layer on top once they've got their symptoms to a level that's quite manageable for them.
It's so fascinating that we might come in with a particular symptom, or we think we're just going to be focusing directly on these gut symptoms, but actually it's all this foundational work that really makes that biggest difference before we can even have a look at what else is going on, or what's maybe still left in terms of the gut symptoms.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing all of that, Nikki. It's been a really interesting conversation, and to learn more about how stress does impact on our gut and our lives in general. Where can listeners connect with you if they want to learn more or reach out?
Well, they can find me. My website is my name, www.nikkihousthouse.com, and also on Instagram as well. It's Nikki Hirsthouse. Trying to keep it nice and simple. And also you can pop on over to social media or my website and download the Ultimate Women's Gut Health Guide, which is usually the first port of call for most women just to start opening their perspective about what it is that affects the gut other than just the food we eat.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm sure that will be really helpful for people to have a bit of a dive into their own symptoms or what might be beneficial to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much, Nikki.
Well, thanks so much, Em. It's been great to chat.
If you have gotten something from today's episode, hit follow to see upcoming episodes and interact with myself and today's guest on Instagram at food.life.freedom. To help more people eat without guilt and feel at peace in their body, leave a 5-star review and share with your community by clicking the 3-dot symbol at the bottom of the episode. For show notes and references, head to foodlifefreedom.com/podcast. And to learn how you can get personalized support with my 3-month Reclaiming Your Food Freedom program, head to foodlifefreedom.com. See you next week.